This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today's show is all about wine. We'll be hearing from self-described troublemaker Austin Hope of Hope Family Wines.
Paso Robles to me is such a gem that I want to share it with everybody. So it's been my mission to get our wines tasted across the world.
Also, Father Ian reports from a food and wine pairing class.
One thing I always say about wine is the more that you know, the less you know. So wine is a constantly changing world.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, September 30th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with Sideways, as the movie celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. Remember Jack and Miles explored the wine region of Santa Ynez? Evan Kleiman of KCRW learns about the movie's lasting effects on the Santa Ynez Valley.
Do not sabotage me. If you want to be a f***ing lightweight, then that's your call, but do not sabotage me.
Oh, aye, Captain, you got it.
And if they want to drink Merlot, we're drinking Merlot.
No, if anybody orders Merlot, I'm leaving. I am not drinking any f***ing Merlot!
Okay, relax, Miles. Jesus, no Merlot. Did you bring your Xanax?
Sideways, a buddy road trip movie with notes of sophistication and self-doubt, celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. The characters of Miles and Jack tool around the Santa Ynez Valley in a wine-colored Saab before Jack's character, played by Thomas Hayden Church, is slated to get married. Frank Ostini, the chef and owner behind The Hitching Post 2, where much of the film takes place, looks back at the two decades of this legendary California wine region and how director Alexander Payne's movie changed everything.
I'm Frank Ostini. I'm chef winemaker of The Hitching Post restaurant in Buellton, California, and Hitching Post Wines, Buellton, California. So I, of course, was born into the family business, 1952, and worked there since I was like 5 years old. I would go out with my dad. I never wanted to be in the business. I saw my parents working too hard. They were not having fun. It was a hard, hard business. Of course, it always is a hard business. But it wasn't till I came back from college. My brother Bill asked me to come and help him run the Hitching Post in Casmelia, the original Hitching Post. That restaurant, of course, started in 1947 as the steakhouse, the Hitching Post. My parents bought it in 1952. And in 1976, I came back from college, actually fell in love with wine. That's what made me fall in love with the restaurant business. Well, we were a restaurant since 1986 here in Buellton. And the author of the book, Sideways, it wasn't a book until after the movie was made, but the man writing it, Rex Pickett, was coming to our bar. He befriended a bartender. He had a crush on a waitress. He told them he was writing them into his book. We thought it would go nowhere. He came back a year later, said he had sold it, showed us a Hollywood Reporter. I've sold this to this guy, Alexander Payne, as a screenplay. So I sold the movie rights. We all thought, well, sold the movie rights. He didn't even publish the book. Years went by. We didn't have any idea there was going to actually be a movie until the location scouts came around in summer of 2003, looking for locations. Not knowing that Alexander Payne had lived in our area for 6 months already, had picked out everything he wanted to be in the movie, and we were lucky enough to be one of those locations. So they filmed the movie Sideways over a six-week period in our region, and they were in my restaurant, The Hitching Post, for 3 days of filming. And they had a glorious time filming. They had such a good time. It was like a party. It came and it went, and we thought it would never come back again. When the movie was finally made ready to be released a year later, they invited all the vintners to a screening at the Arlington Theater in Santa Barbara. And this was the American premiere of Sideways at our Arlington Theater in Santa Barbara. So we have no idea what we're going to see. And I was shell-shocked. I was stunned how well we were shown, how much we were shown, how much the Santa Barbara, the wine of Santa Barbara, the whole story of everything we had been doing for 20 years, how it was in the background of this movie in such a wonderful way. We still at that point had no idea if anybody was going to see it. So after we saw it in September of 2004, we still didn't know anybody was going to ever see this movie. We were invited to the New York Film Festival by Searchlight and the film, the Alexander Payne, to show wine around the showing of the movie at the New York Film Festival. So it was the closing act, the closing movie of that festival at Lincoln Center, and there was over 2,000 people in the audience. And I was in the balcony in the back, I'll never forget it. People were basically rolling in the aisles. And it was that point we went, my God, they like it. Because we couldn't tell. I mean, it was all so much about us. We couldn't tell if it was really something that made sense to anybody else. It did to us. And then that's when we knew it was going to happen. And it had the most organic, slow build. It got critical acclaim, won a few awards, and then was up for the Academy Award, won Best Adapted Screenplay. And it just kept growing. Every month it grew. I think our business at the restaurant grew 5% a month for 8 months and increased by 40%. And we just couldn't do anymore. And we kept that constant for many years. But seeing 2,000 people loving that movie, we knew it was going to happen. The whole thing scared me. A whole bunch. Success. Like, I didn't know how I would approach it. I actually fell back to my parents when they were in the most difficult time, what they focused on, back to the basics. Really high quality food, really good value, and real hospitality. Just make people feel good. So what worked in the worst of times, I thought would be key to work in the best of times. And that's how we kept our heads on straight. We'd been in the business, you know, almost 30 years already. And of course, my family in it for longer. My dad did it for 25 years. And gosh, those last 20 years that since Sideways, it's like a blur. In the old days before Sideways, I mean, we had wine geeks that came to Santa Barbara, and a lot of older wine drinkers knew about Santa Barbara. The young hip people did not know about it. This brought all these young people to the region to enjoy Pinot Noir. And, you know, our brands of Pinot increased from, I don't know, 20 or 30 of them before the movie to hundreds of Pinot Noirs in Santa Barbara now. And now we have younger winemakers starting in the business, and they want to make natural wine. They want to do skin contact white wines, orange wines. They want to do pet nats. They biodynamic farming. There's a movement to make everything better. But, you know, we're still a rural part of California. If you go north of Santa Barbara, it's cattle country and vineyards, wide open spaces. We hope to preserve that country atmosphere that we've always had and enjoy it as long as we can. We don't have massive overdevelopment or anything. Santa Barbara has always controlled growth, and so we can still enjoy a really pastoral atmosphere here in our part of the San Ynez Valley.
That story was from Evan Kleiman of KCRW Public Radio. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. The next stop on our wine tour is downtown Paso Robles, where correspondent Tom Wilmer chats with Austin Hope in his new tasting room.
All them cats is drinking that wine.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer
reporting from downtown Paso Robles at the new Hope on Park tasting room. Join us for a conversation with second-generation wine grower Austin Hope. Hope is the owner and winemaker at Hope Family Wines, which was named the American Winery of the Year by Wine Enthusiast magazine in 2022. Here we are, downtown Paso Robles, right off the park. Tasting room?
This is a whole new concept that we've created. We have our main tasting cellar is just off of 46 West, off of Arbor Road. That's where we've been for many years, but I've always had a dream to be downtown, be part of the community, be facing the park, which is the symbol of really this amazing little city we live in. And we had an opportunity to acquire a building downtown facing, so we're at 1140 Park Street. We decided to create the first ever sidewalk tasting bar.
So you ripped off the whole front wall of the building, didn't you?
Exactly. We ripped front of it off, opened it up, so it's just a big bifold door opens up right to the sidewalk, and so people can just walk by and come in, grab a glass of wine, do a tasting, grab a wine to go, a wine cocktail to go. What really got us started was Triana Red. Was our first real jump into thing was 1996 vintage. And so we're tasting some of those wines back to like 99 and through. So it really gives you a whole different perspective of
things. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Better and better to a point.
Some of them do, some of them don't. Yep. Yeah. But you get to kind of experience that and kind of walk down the lane. And our stewards are really, they're storytellers. So, I mean, you're not only learning about the wine itself, but you're learning about the history of our family, of the community, of how this region became. So it's really, it's a fun thing, and it's not a rushed tasting. It's as long as you want to be here.
Let's back up for a moment.
When we got here in 78, my mom and dad planted wine grapes, so they were definitely early pioneers in the region. As we grew, we became farmers and sold our grapes to other wineries.
Just growers.
Right. We decided to build a bed and breakfast and a tasting room.
Where?
That's us off 46 West. It was called Arbor Inn. It's now Summerwood.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's beautiful.
So
place.
We built that in 87.
Nice.
And my dad put together a group of all the old early pioneers of the region and said, hey, I'm going to build this. You guys invest. And so we had like 16, 18 different people in the community that invested into this program. And the wine people that were invested in it, they made the wines from our grapes. So we basically did, it was a very mom and pop type situation.
That's right.
We had some estate grown grapes there. We had vineyards because we had the West Side Vineyard where we live today. And then we had two or three on the east side of town. So we had big vineyards kind of scattered all over the place because that's what our primary thing was. As that progressed, I was very interested in wine part of it, and my dad had brought his brother in. He was doing wine pushing. We were making bulk wine and selling it, and then we ended up meeting another winemaker from Napa Valley that liked the Cabernet we were making for bulk wine, bought it. We became friends, and over the time, it was Chuck Wagner from Camus. He had a Liberty School label, and that label, we started growing for it. Then pretty soon, we were making it in Paso. Then pretty soon, we were bottling it in Paso. So as that transpired over time, we decided, why don't we take over the Liberty School label since we're already growing it, making it, bottling it, and we wanted to create a winery, which was Triana. So we decided to put a partnership together, and we took Liberty School over, and we were going to start Triana. And my uncle was going to run that part of it because I was pretty young. My uncle passed away, and my father said, can you do this? And why not? So I was 22.
No fear.
Yeah, 22, 23 years old, and brought Jesse from the fields where I've hoed weeds my whole life with, and I said, come on, you're going to learn to make wine. And then we just went at it, and I brought a salesperson on, and we started making wine and selling wine, and then now we've grown to a much larger scale. It's still a family operation, and it's pretty cool. But over the time, we had, to get to your question about vineyards and such, I joke about it. We got into the wine business the old-fashioned way. We didn't have any money, so as we were building the winery and buying tanks and barrels and growing, we started selling vineyards to afford to be able to do that because there was so much debt involved. So over the time, now we just have our estate vineyard where my parents live on. We live on.
How many acres is
it's
that?
It's about a 70-acre vineyard just right there. Amazing place to be that close to town and be on 70 acres.
Yeah. So going back in time, I remember interviewing a guy named Richard Smith that had Paraiso up in Monterey. Yeah, he was one of the pioneers of modern iteration.
100%.
And I said, dude, he made a lot of mistakes. I mean, he had to rip out 20 acres of this and rip out 20 acres of that. Then the next guy comes along and thinks, you know, new square one.
Yep.
So since you've been going back in the day when Richard was doing his thing, Mistakes. What mistakes did you make and how did you learn from that?
I've made a ton of mistakes. Well, there's a saying that my father has. He's a quote guy. I actually made a book for his 70th birthday of 70 different quotes my father said.
Oh, cool.
And one is, don't believe your own hype. You get going, you have a little bit of success, and you think you know what's going on, and you really don't. You know, we've almost been bankrupt while I've been running this company. And we turned it around, we learned from it, and we make better decisions. I think that's really not believing your own hype. It says so much to that. And the other thing I think we've done to learn from mistakes is I listen. I'm a very astute listener to distributors, to consumers, to people around me, and then I'll make my decision based off of what I've heard. So where I think people get in trouble in this industry particularly is because of their ego. For whatever reason, there's a tremendous amount of ego in the wine business, and you cannot use ego. You know, we've made the wrong varieties. One thing we've done wrong multiple times is we're ahead of the curve. It's comical now because we've had success and the whole team, that amazing crew. But sometimes I would come up with ideas and we would try and launch them. Like, tried to launch a box wine like 8 years ago, a premium box wine. Couldn't get that going. Now it's all the rage, right? And so we laugh about it. I tried to do the RTDs. We made a little thing called a Copa like 6-7 years ago, maybe longer.
What is that?
It was like the first really iteration of a ready-to-drink canned cocktail or mm-hmm. canned wine, mm-hmm. all of that. And I couldn't get anybody to go on. It was basically looked like a little tennis ball holder, and it would pop top like that, and we put one of our wines, Troublemaker, in it. And I took it all over the state, all over the country, and tried to sell that to people, and they're like, no, we don't see it. And now they're everywhere, right? So we've done a lot of
things. So timing is everything, isn't it?
Timing's huge. Yeah. We've launched a Merlot brand, did a whole national campaign, and literally that movie came out. Mm-hmm. Like the year into this whole campaign we did, going off, and we were doing well with it. Candor was the name of the brand, and it was a great Merlot. And then Sideways came out, movie, you know, the quote of F. Merlot, and
that was really sad.
It's super sad. It killed that brand. We tabled that brand, and it went away. We struggled for 2 or 3 years with it, and I'm like, what?
We had any accidental home runs?
We've had an accidental home run with the Graciano, a variety that we were not supposed to have. We planted it on our estate. It was supposed to be the Spanish clone of Mourvedre. It's supposed to be the Monastrell clone. It's a really special clone. Well, when they did the budding, there's also a variety called Monastrell, which is known as Graciano, and they budded the wrong thing. So we planted it, we grew it up.
And you didn't know?
I had no idea. Planted right next to a Mourvedre block in our ranch. And so we we looked at it, and I said, man, it sure looks different. It's very, tastes different, the wine's different. The next year I went to one of my neighbor friends, and Justin Smith from Saxum, and I called him and I said, hey, I'm going to send you a ton of this new Monastrell clone. It's really weird. It doesn't taste like Mourvedre. It doesn't look like Mourvedre. And he goes, I got that clone too, because there was only a handful of us in the very beginning that was able to get that clone. He says, I don't think it's Mourvedre. So he sent it into Davis, and they DNA'd it, and it wasn't. So it comes back as this Graciano. And I was so frustrated, right? And the nursery was like, well, you know, but it's making good wine. I said, no, it's not making good wine. I'm having a heck of a time trying to figure out how to make this wine, because it was super high in acid. It was black as night could get. Tannins, it had weird fruit flavors. And so we struggled with it a couple of years. We figured it out. I said, okay, we made a wine. I'm like, this is good. Let's see what we do with it.
So it was a blend that made it work?
No, we just started fermenting different and picking at different times, aging it differently. And then we started using more new wood, and we were able to actually turn this wine into a lush kind of, but still a racy red.
What a paradox.
Super paradox. And we put it in our tasting cellar, and now we can't make enough of it.
How cool.
And I'm just, it's crazy.
Well, that being said, what happens when you library it and just park it for a while in the bottle?
In the bottle, yeah. It just changes and morphs around. And
does it get better?
Hard question to answer, because it depends on if you like wines with aged characters. That's another notion, right? It gets better with time. Well, it's like, no, the reason that was said is because in Europe, mostly Bordeaux, for example, is really, other than the soils, it's the wrong place to grow grape. They've got great soils, but the soils are man-made. I mean, they dug all that gravel out of those locks and made Bordeaux.
Interesting.
But the weather's always too cold, so you can never get these wines physiologically ripe. So, because they couldn't get them any riper. Mm-hmm. Then you'd have to lay them down because they were so hard, so tough. And like that's why that term stopped.
Interesting.
But we spent a lifetime basically understanding tannins and how to make wines not only approachable, fresh, and youthful upon release, but still have enough tannin and structure to last 20 plus years in the bottle. So when you do taste a wine that's older, I mean, I enjoy them, but I always tell people, take a wine, if you're going to age wines, take one and age it for, you know, whatever, 10 years, and then take that one bottle to a party, or open that one bottle up at a party, and let everybody taste it. And then have another one of like the new vintage. You'll watch most of the people, they'll taste it and say, oh, that's really cool. But then they'll go to the other wine.
Interesting.
Because they like fresh, bright, rich wines. Mm-hmm.
There's some crazy stat about when a bottle is sold in a liquor store or grocery store, statistically is consumed, what, within 30 hours or something?
Oh, yeah. It's something like that. It's less than a day for sure. It's not. I think it's like 10 hours or something like that. Mm-hmm. With twist-offs, now you can drink it on the way home.
Yeah, for sure. You can't sell everything locally.
No.
You have to distribute.
And we do. More importantly, what I believe in is the community and the region and Paso, because I think Paso Robles to me is such a gem that I want to share it with everybody. Mm-hmm. So it's been my mission to get our wines tasted across the world, right. So much so that we have global people now. So we have two people that work for us in the export market. Newest country was Armenia. We just went into there last week.
Wow.
So we're in 48 countries now.
Part of being successful in distribution is creativity in the label and the name. Does Troublemaker fit in there a little bit?
That's what was my nickname as a child, because I was always in trouble. So that was that.
But nonetheless, it works. It has that buzz in a grocery store or whatever, liquor store. It gets your attention.
It does. I think about that more than you can imagine, because the consumers are the ones that dictate our success, right? Mm-hmm. And when you walk into supermarkets or stores, it's just like, wow, you're inundated. So yeah, so label does have a big part of it. One of the things we've been very successful at is consumer trial. So we've spent enormous amount of money when we start with a brand to incentivize a restaurant to pour it by the glass. Mm-hmm. And through that, a lot of people, they get nervous and they don't want to do it because it's extremely expensive to do. But the consumer trial is how we drive our success. We just released a little wine that's very light Grenache, real low alcohol, like 9%, 10% alcohol. And then I wanted it to have a little spritz to it, you know? So we with our new equipment we have at our bottling facility, we can inject CO2. And so now, and then I said, you got to serve it cold. So it's this cold, light, refreshing, like
great summer.
Watermelon, strawberry. It's just like, oh my God, it's so
that's
amazing.
A summertime.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Pull out of the fridge, you get home, have a little glass. It's amazing.
Nice.
A new brand we just released called Austin. A really interesting brand. If you go to a marketing school, they would tell you you're doing absolutely the wrong thing. But on the top label where the brand name should go is very huge. It says Paso Robles. And then down at the bottom in the corner, it just says Austin in very small, and then Cabernet. And we did that again, for the love of the region. We're trying to push the region. I want everybody, my goal is to have Paso Robles is a household name, just like Napa is globally.
Was Paso Robles AVA always an exceptional wine growing region, or was there an evolution because of the injection of the thinking of the growers?
I think it's always been. The potential has always been there because of the soils. Yeah. And that's another thing how special this place is. You know, we've not only do we have the Paso Robles AVA, but over the years now we've broken it into 11 different sub-AVAs, which is amazing because it shows the diversity of what this region can do, right? Mm-hmm. We can grow Syrah, far west side, and it tastes a certain way. And then you go to the Chandon area, which is, you know, relatively not that far away. Mm-hmm. Also, winemakers have gotten better, growers have gotten better. One big initiative that we have, it's taken us 8 years to do, but we did it, and this was the first year that we can say it 100% now, is we're 100% sustainably grown.
Talk to us for a moment about that.
It really takes a look at the whole holistic journey of growing grapes and farming and winemaking and the human aspect of it is what I like about it. Are you taking care of your people? Do they have health insurance? Or do they have a livable wage? Is their workplace environment safe? You're not using harsh chemicals. You use philosophies like, if I need to spray bugs, Where are the bugs at? Okay, well, the bugs are in block 1B, only in this corner. So traditional farming, like the way I grew up, was we would nuke that whole place. Mm-hmm. We'd nuke 100 acres just if there was bugs in an acre. And now we go with different products, like stylet oils and neem, different things that are out there that you go and attack that little area.
And how about introducing bugs? Like, was that minute pirate bug?
Mm-hmm. We plant a cover crop around in corridors mm-hmm. that encourage all these beneficial bugs that eat the other ones. So being 100% sustainable has been amazing. You know, and that goes into consideration of water. You don't need to use so much water. Use technology. Technology has been amazing for us in this industry. If you're ahead of it and you're in the game and not trying to be this old world, and I love the old world, but even the old world now is using technology. It's because you can be better and you can be more conscious and conserve more. Put a moisture meter in the ground. That tells you when to water. Not mm-hmm. just like your grandfather said, why water when I see it needs water? It's like, well, maybe it doesn't need water. So being forward thinking, I think, is one of the biggest things that we've been aggressive at from the beginning. And I think it shows to the consumers why we're having so much success.
That's really cool.
Carrying on with the sustainability conversation, why it's such a large undertaking mm-hmm. is because you're dealing with growers and their sole livelihood is to grow a grape and get it to market. And they get paid. They get paid once a year. When we wineries, you know, there's always been a rib between wineries and growers. When it's time to pick, they want to pick. They don't want to be messing around. And sometimes we wait. And sometimes we'll say, well, they're not physically ripe. And then that pisses them off. So we've had this struggle over the years. But what we've done is getting them to get on this journey with us of making growing sustainable grapes. We've had to help incentivize them. We've had to show them. We've taken our state property. It's a fully regenerative farm. So we've gone to the next level. We've even gone farther. So now there's no tilling. There's all these things that we're doing that are very beneficial. So we've shown to our growers, look, it's possible. It can be done. Yes, it's more expensive, so we pay it more. Mm-hmm. And that's been the struggle. I've wanted to keep spraying because that's what we do. I'm like, well, why? Because that's what we do. And I'm like, you know, that's what you've done. But Stacy's been amazing about educating them. And showing them, like, I mean, just the tilth of the soils, like on places that are not being sprayed all the time, not being dissed all the time. And you can see the whole soil comes alive. I mean, the microbes and bugs and all these things is happening. And so it makes the soil healthier. So you need less fertilizers. You need less different products that they put on all the time that cost more money. So in the long term, they actually will save money and make a higher quality product that's better for you. But it's challenging. It was a real challenge to be able to get that many growers to be, and we had to put a foot down. It's like, this is our initiative, and by 2025, if you are not sustainable, then you can't farm for us. So everybody's more conscious.
Yeah, Carl Wente said, if you don't have a sustainability model, you better work on an exit strategy.
It's true. So. Getting people to think longer term and less, you know, short-sighted. I mean, my father's come around to it all, and he sees it, and he's as old school as it gets.
For a moment before we go, in the growing world of grapes in California, there's some bizarro stuff going on, man. People reneging on contracts and price per acre, per ton, plummeting. What's going on?
Well, I think we've hit another one of our moments in the wine industry where, you know, it seems like it's about every 10-year cycle that we run into where there'll be too many grapes, or then there's not enough grapes. And we're in that cycle right now. And so, and then the other thing that's changed too is
but they're ripping vines out.
And a lot of vines need to be ripped out. So some of it's positive, some of it's negative. Things cycle and varieties cycle. The Pinot was so hot there years ago. Everybody and their brother and sister planted Pinot. Mm-hmm. Well, then it gets to a certain point. There's only so much market you can have. And then when you speak to the dropping contracts, these are typically being done by large corporations that a lot of them publicly traded, and it becomes a commodity thing with them. It's like, okay, we make all this, and we push as hard as we can, and then we can't sell anymore, then we just bail out. And then plus, you know, the consumption's down a little bit, but we've been through it before. You're gonna wash out some of the folks that probably shouldn't have been doing what they were doing, maybe get some better vineyards out of it, maybe get rid of some wines that were not that great.
Austin Hope, thank you for the time. This has been great.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Paso Robles, California.
The This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Father Ian of Playing with Food takes us to a wine and food pairing class.
So our first mug, this is a Sauvignon Blanc. What are we going to expect before we even put our nose in or we taste
it? Wine, it's all around us on the Central Coast, and there's so much to learn.
Exactly. And it's an aromatic wine, so we're going to hope that we don't have to stick our nose deep in. So it is jumping out, right? Very pronounced.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dumlinger, and I'm playing with food.
Okay, next up, remember we were talking about Syrah and Shiraz?
Melanie Weber is teaching a class about wine. The class is the Wine and Spirit Education Trust, or WSET, Level 1 Award, which is a beginner-level introduction to wine suitable for those starting a wine career or pursuing an interest in wine, according to the WSET website. 10 students started at 9 a.m. to learn the basics of wine, growing grapes, making wine, the types and styles of wine, grape varietals, storage, and service. Then the fun part happened before I got there. The students got an introduction to tasting. And then the really fun part started when I arrived, pairing wine with food. So let's step into the classroom for the next several minutes.
So these food pairings, there are reasons why these work together. There are some principles that will explain why these food and wine pairings work well together. But when you're doing food and wine pairing, the personal preferences matter. We're all different. Personal preferences do matter. In food and wine pairing, it's actually the food that causes more problems than the wine. The wine is not going to make the food taste bad, but the food could have an impact on the wine. But for the most part, you're not going to have many of those orange juice and toothpaste moments with food and wine. Most wines will be fine for most people with most foods. There's nature and there's nurture. Some of our sensitivities are predetermined, literally, by our biology. Each one of you has a plate. On your plate, there is a little plastic cup with a white strip in it. Take that strip, put it on your tongue, and when you feel or taste something, I want you to sit down. So everybody stand up. Count of three. One, two, three. Oh, wow. Interesting. Okay, those of you who are still standing, it's just like a piece of paper in your mouth, right?
That's pretty close.
Nothing. Those who sat down, what happened? So those of you who sat down have probably more taste buds and are more sensitive. So you guys have to be really careful about food and wine pairings where the food can really bring out the bitterness in wine. But ultimately, the point of the exercise is just to show that genetically we have differences in the way we respond. We talked about the five things we can taste: sweet, umami, salt, acid, and bitterness. What is umami? Yummy, savory. What are some foods that have umami? Mushrooms, miso, steak. If the food is umami, it's going to make the wine seem drier, more bitter, more acidic, and less sweet and fruity. Umami has the potential to be a wine enemy. However, salt is a food friend. And salt kind of has the same impact on wine that it does when you put it on the food. Right? It just makes it taste better. So if the food has salt in it, it's going to make the wine taste less drying and bitter, less acidic, more fruity, and it's going to make the wine seem like it has more body. Acid. Acid in food can be a wine friend because it has a similar impact that salt does. It makes the wine seem less dry and bitter, less acidic, more sweet and fruity. You want to match intensity with intensity. So if you have really highly flavored foods, you don't want like a really delicate wine. So if there's fat or oil in the food, it coats your tongue. By coating your tongue, it can make the wine seem less acidic. That's why something like oysters and champagne or French fries and champagne work so well, because the fattiness of those oysters or the oiliness is going to coat your tongue a little bit and make the wine seem a little less acidic. And then finally, chili or hot food. If the food is really spicy, it will heighten the impact of the alcohol in the wine. And vice versa, if the wine is high alcohol, it's really going to blow up the spice in the food. What you have on your plate, you have salt, lemon for acid, the Parmesan for umami, the salmon for fat, the sweet, we have a meringue and we have a biscuit. And then those chips, which you do not touch until the very end of this exercise, are ghost pepper chips.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian at Broken Earth Winery in Paso Robles, observing a WSET introductory wine course. Wine educator Melanie Weber just took the class through an introduction to pairing wine with food. Absolutely fun activity. She took us through each of the five tastes we can sense: sweetness, sourness or acidity, saltiness, fattiness, and savoriness or umami. And then we paired each wine with each taste. I wanted to know more about how one gets such a fantastic job.
My name is Melanie Weber, and I'm a wine educator. I run the MW Wine School, which is based in Paso Robles, and we work out of the Broken Earth Winery. This morning I taught WSET Level 1 Award in Wine. WSET is a globally recognized wine education certification, and Level 1 is the intro level of those courses. So it's a fantastic class for people who are just starting their wine education. We have a lot of wine industry professionals in the class. It's also great for people who just love wine and want to learn more. And in the class I teach so the basics of wine. We teach wine and food pairing, how to analyze and taste a glass of wine. We learn the major grapes, and we taste a lot of wine.
What can a person do with this certification once they've accomplished it?
It's a good credential if you want to work in the wine industry. It shows that you have actually been through a very globally recognized wine education course. I have a lot of people in my classes who were sent to my classes from wineries and from tasting rooms, so they have more knowledge, they can better communicate with the customers. And again, it's a prerequisite for level 2, and then on to level 3, and then on to level 4, and you know, the sky's the limit after that.
And as you move up those levels, is there an end point?
One thing I always say about wine is the more that you know, the less you know. So wine is a constantly changing world, and there's so much information. But in terms of certification, level 4, the diploma, which is what I have, is sort of the end point of the WSET program. Then if you're really like want to be one of like 400 in the world, you go on to get your Master of Wine, and that takes probably another 5 to 7 years.
Are sommeliers in there somewhere?
Oh yes, okay. All the way up the line. Level 1 probably not so much, but when you get to level 2 and then level 3, yes, you're definitely qualified to be a somm or a wine director.
Have you seen lots of shifting in the industry?
Oh yes. Well, one of the things actually that I feel very proud of is being part of kind of the trend to micro-production small lot winemakers, which the Garagiste Festival shone a light on those winemakers. So I've seen that shift toward real emphasis on artisan winemakers. But everything changes. I was just in Rioja in Spain this summer. Like many other regions, they're actually changing their classification systems to focus more on site and on terroir. Of course, we've got natural wines, we've got orange wines, we've got non-alcoholic wines. I mean, they're just multitude of changes. And the information keeps changing because there are so many wine regions in the world that their rules keep changing. And then, of course, there's climate change, which is having a huge impact. For example, in Bordeaux, they've now allowed, I think it's 11 new grapes in.
Is the food pairing part of the class?
The food pairing is very much a WSET protocol and one that I admire very much. I actually think it's a very effective program. And I appreciate that the first rule is that there are no rules and that personal preferences matter, but that here are some principles that have led to the classic food and wine pairings and that can help you if you really want to have an enhanced food and wine pairing.
I really like how you say that, because when I started wine tasting 30 some years ago, that was not the case. There were hard and fast rules, and this is what you are tasting in the wine, and if you're tasting something else, you're doing it wrong. And I still overhear people in tasting rooms do some of that.
One of the students in the class said to me today, opened a Sauternes Premier Cru Classe 2007. And one of the students said to me, is there something wrong with me? I don't like it. What does that mean? I said, it means you don't like it. We try to create a framework with a systematic approach to tasting at WSET, but that's just so that we can work inside a box so that then people can expand. You taste what you taste, you smell what you smell, but the more you do it, you can educate your palate. I'm totally opposed to wine snobbery, but I also think it's great to have a discipline, sort of an equation for assessing wine quality aside from your personal preferences.
So my first experience was a friend from college came and visited, and what do? You take them wine tasting because you live in California.
California, right? Didn't know anything about wine, 22 years old. And we go up to Napa and we go to the first winery on the right-hand side of the road north of Napa. In the early 90s, there was a way to drink wine. There was a way to pair wine. There was, this is what this wine tastes like. The person in the tasting room was 30 years ahead of her time because she said, you like what you like, you taste what yes. you taste. We got to the red wine and I said, it tastes like beef blood. And she said, if that's what it tastes like to you, that's what it tastes like exactly. to you. If she would have been really strict and told me I was wrong, I probably wouldn't have continued wine tasting.
Right. I think there's a happy medium between learning the discipline and tasting what you taste. We do an exercise in the class with the bitter strips, which measures literally genetically, people have different responses to bitterness. You know, you have to strike the balance between people's personal preferences are, what their subjective view is, and then still create a framework that will enable you to analyze a wine. But for the average person, what you taste is what you taste.
The more you drink, and the more different types you drink, the more you learn why that framework is in place.
One glass at a time. That's how you learn, one glass at a time. And the more that you practice breaking it down as you drink, the better you get. A lot of times I just drink a glass of wine and drink it. I don't sit there and go, okay, this is this. And, you know, I just enjoy the experience. But it is a really good discipline that helps to train your palate.
So, did our palates get trained? You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm at Broken Earth Winery with wine educator Melanie Weber. The assignment was to create a 3-course meal from the options she provided and pair a wine from the list with each course. Here's what came up for the person sitting next to me, and then for me.
My name is Julie. I have a background in biochemistry and chemistry, so I've been interested in winemaking, how wine is made, as well as pairings and things that have to do with chemistry and food chemistry, how that all sort of intermixes. So it's personal interest for me to further my knowledge of wines, and also maybe at some point I would like to maybe pour wine in a tasting room or some setting like that. That's my goal, but I need to learn about wines first because I don't know a lot at all. I have zero knowledge coming into this class, so...
Do you have experience, though?
Experience drinking or serving? Drinking, yeah, I do. I do have experience drinking.
You were asked to choose a 3-course meal and choose from the wine list which wines to go with each course. Yeah. What did you choose?
I haven't quite finished it yet. I got as far as I would choose oysters with steak and chocolate cake. And I know that the food consideration for the oysters would be fatty, oily food. Steak is savory, umami. Then the chocolate is sweet, but I still have to think about more about the wines. I haven't finished it yet.
Okay, tell me when you finish.
Okay, I will.
She got there soon enough.
I chose the oysters, and I chose the New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Nice white, just to mix well with the food oils.
And what is the characteristic of Sauvignon Blanc that makes
the acidity?
The acidity, yes.
And I chose the steak because it's savory, and I chose the South African Cabernet Sauvignon because it's a classic pairing.
It's a classic pairing, and again, we have that little concern about the umami, but because we've got the salt in the steak, it's going to soften a little bit the tannins in the Cabernet Sauvignon.
And then the chocolate cake being very sweet. I chose a Prosecco. I don't know if that's what I thought.
Yeah, the Prosecco, it's a medium sweet wine. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, you don't want something that's dry because the sweetness in the cake will make that wine even drier, more acidic. So the Prosecco is a really great choice.
Right. I didn't want to choose a really sweet wine with that. That didn't sound good to me anyway, but this sounded nice.
Yeah.
Like a nice pairing.
Good work. Yes. And are you going?
Sure. I wasn't in the class this morning, but I'll go anyway.
Yeah.
I chose the salad, and to go with that, I chose the Australian Chardonnay.
Yes.
Okay. To kind of balance out the acid.
Yes.
I'm really sensitive to vinaigrettes, and they like make my lips tingle, so I want something to balance that off.
Okay.
And I don't like oysters. For the main course, I chose the Chateauneuf du Pape, because if a Chateauneuf du Pape is on the menu, that's what I'm going to choose.
Okay, so you went for the wine before the food.
I did.
That's good. A lot of people do that.
Yeah.
And then you looked in the menu and what works best with it, and you went with the steak.
I went with the steak,
okay. Yes.
And then I went with the chocolate cake and port, because that's kind of classic pairing.
Excellent, yes.
It was a fun day of learning for everyone, and here's what a few students had to say.
It was fun. It was a learning experience for sure. Came in here a little nervous, but the instructor made me feel confident, and I learned a lot within one day. That was cool, and we just finished the exam.
How do you think you did on the exam?
It's been a while since I've taken one, but I always try to be confident, but I feel like I did good. Yeah. What's the best thing you learned in today's class?
The food and wine pairing portion was the most insightful.
Being able to distinguish the differences between acidity, tannins, body, how heavy the wine is, everything to describe it, the characteristics about it. Yeah, so I have a better understanding of all that. I'm more confident now in describing and explaining wine.
Learned a lot about food pairings, especially. That was probably the biggest takeaway. Also learned about different regions in France and different wines that come out of them. Learned a lot of red wine knowledge from my work, a little bit into white wines. But learned a lot more depth through that and a lot more complexities about white wines.
There's a lot of complexity. There's a lot of French terminology that we depend on and how that they are referred to based on their region and not necessarily based on the grape type, versus in the United States, we really refer to the grape type more.
But I don't really know food pairing all that well. So being able to put the two together and see like how lemon or how acidities and how salt really brings out different flavors in different wines.
So when trying to pair the wine with a meal, I was trying to pair an entire meal. I was trying to just sell them one wine fits all.
And after you said that, I was like, Chateauneuf pub. It's like, if I'm going to pick a bottle, it's going to be the Chateauneuf pub, right. Particularly if somebody else is paying.
There's one last thing that Melanie spoke about, the
The Garagiste Wine Festival. It's our 13th year in Paso Robles. It's November 9th and 10th. We're celebrating Gary Eberle. We'll have 60 winemakers who make under 1,500 cases of wine from the Paso Robles Central Coast area pouring their wines. It's a lot of fun. It's a no snobs allowed event, and it's different from other wine events because the people are very serious about the wines and the winemakers pour. So when you go to the wine festival, you get to talk to the winemaker. Garagiste, so it means garage in French. They have a lot of very strict rules in the appellations in France about what grapes can be used, what yields, what winemaking techniques. So this group of rebel winemakers decided they were going to make wines however they wanted to make them. And they were small production, and so the chateaus kind of looked down their noses and said, oh, they're making their wines in their garages. Hence, they called them garagistes, and it was like a negative term. But then Robert Parker came along, discovered their wines, and they became some of the most expensive wines in the world. So that's how the garagiste term, it was originally meant by the chateaus as a negative term for these winemakers, but now it means winemakers who make wine against the rules, who make high-quality, small-production wines. The festival originated in Paso Robles.
Oh, okay.
We just took that name. Doug and Stuart, who founded the festival, they thought it was a great name because that's who our winemakers are. They are these small production, high quality rebel winemakers. Gary Eberle, he has Eberle Winery. He's a pioneer of Paso Robles winemaking. He pretty much helped put Paso Robles on the map as a world-class wine region.
More on the Garagiste Wine Festival in the coming months. Wine. It's all around us on the Central Coast, and there's so much to learn. You can learn the fun way, like I did, 30 plus years of drinking wine, and I can still only tell you enough to be annoying. Or you can take a class. They are taught at Broken Earth Winery fairly regularly. But remember one thing, if nothing else.
One glass at a time, right? That's how you learn, one glass at a time. Absolutely. And the more that you practice breaking it down as you drink, the better you get. A lot of times I just drink a glass of wine and drink it. You know, I just enjoy the experience.
Go out and enjoy the experience. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Finally, here in California, we like to consider a blend of music and winemaking. An artist on the Central Coast takes that connection especially seriously. Brooke Monroe spent years making an album full of sounds from a vineyard. Former KCBX News Director Benjamin Perper takes us on a sonic journey through a Central Coast wine harvest.
It's a foggy morning at a small, family-owned winery called Claiborne in Churchill in San Luis Obispo's Edna Valley, one of the Central Coast's most iconic wine destinations. It's 8 a.m. before anyone shows up to the winery, and for composer and winemaker Brooke Monroe, that's the perfect time to tune in to the sounds of the vineyard.
This is our Riesling vineyard here, and if we get quiet...
He's standing perfectly still, listening to a chorus of birds and insects.
You know, there's an ecosystem out there. That's quite fascinating.
This is what Brooks spent many months doing, walking through this vineyard and recording these sounds. He's been a manager at Claiborne and Churchill for more than 15 years, so he knows this vineyard intimately. He's also a lifelong musician. He's toured with a rock band called The Mighty Fine and scored several indie films. In 2021, he set out to create his first solo project, one that combined his love of winemaking with his love of music.
It's a wild concept, turning wine into music, but to me, I felt like it had to be done because I am in a very unique situation. I don't know many composers who are also like full-time in the wine industry.
Over the course of 2 years and two harvests, he created his debut solo album, Harvest in 12 Parts.
The artistry of winemaking and music making are quite similar. There's a lot of inputs and a lot of variables that are controlled and some that are not controlled, but at the end of the day, whether it's sipping a glass of wine or putting headphones on and taking a listen to something, you know, there's so much that goes into that.
Creating music out of vineyard sounds required a unique approach. Brooke had to find sounds he could record, put into his music software, and manipulate. One day, he was walking through the grapevines, and the trellis wire supporting them gave him an idea.
I'd pull on this wire, and the wire would screech against the rust here, and a really ear-piercing sound. And it sounded horrible, but there was a fundamental pitch to it. I recorded it on my phone, but rather than recording in real time, I recorded it in slow motion. And in doing so, all that playback, because it slows down, it also pitches down. And so now, when it pitches down two or three octaves, now you have a fundamental tone that actually has this cool, like, simple, compelling sound that it's actually the first tone that you hear on the first track, Jubileum.
But as you can hear, that trellis wire tone isn't the only sound.
I blended that in with birds from the vineyard. But those birds that you hear in there, I manipulated in such a way that you know that they're birds, but I definitely processed them in such a way that, like, I wanted to evoke this sense of, like, okay, we're going to start this journey and we're going to start getting in. And then, like, cello comes in.
That combination of traditional instruments and digitally processed vineyard sounds makes up most of the album. But it's often hard to tell the difference between the two. That's because Brooke basically made those sounds into instruments. He recorded things like the sound of wine glasses, manipulated them into a single pitch, and then mapped that pitch onto a virtual keyboard, meaning he could now play that sound like he would a piano. Inside the tasting room, he grabs a wine glass to demonstrate.
So I would, with a field recorder and with a mallet, soft mallet, record that sound. And then, you know, through some digital processing, I could then create this really cool sound where it sounded almost like a high-end mallet or xylophone, almost like a toy piano.
Harvest in 12 Parts is full of this kind of experimentation. Brooke takes me to a giant metal storage tank, opens it up, and does this. Brooke recorded a friend singing into the tank to create the song Becoming. He plays it for me on his phone.
That's all Kate's voice.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
There was only one track without any vineyard sounds, but it was still inspired by the winemaking process. This is Harvest for Orchestra, recorded by the Cape Town Philharmonic. But this album isn't just a fun exercise in making music out of wine. For Brooke, each song tells a story, even if there aren't any words, like the track What We Overcome.
It was kind of a post-harvest, like towards the end of harvest, it had started raining, recorded the sound of the rain in the vineyard.
Rain is a good thing when it helps vines grow, but too much rain can damage grapes that are reaching full size.
It felt dire, you know, being out in the vineyard late in the harvest season, and just this idea that there's times that we're facing challenges or obstacles, but you know you have to overcome it.
There's a reason Harvest in 12 Parts took Brooke 2 years to create. It isn't easy making any album. Making an album like this is a whole nother level. Capturing the sounds, manipulating them, composing the music, recording the instruments, mixing, mastering, mostly by himself, took a lot of work and time. That's on top of his job at the winery. Brooke says it's unlike anything he's ever done, and it's changed how he sees himself creatively.
You know, I've always considered myself a musician, a composer. I never really saw myself as a quote-unquote artist until I finished Harvest in 12 Parts. And then I felt like, okay, if someone wants to lump me in that category, like, oh, he's an artist, then I wouldn't be able to deny it at that point.
Brooke Monroe says he hopes Harvest in 12 Parts inspires others to embrace experimentation in music and wine.
I know if someone else took their experiences into the vineyard and into the cellar and into the barrel room and they crafted something musically or artistically, that it would be beautiful. And it wouldn't sound like me, it would sound like them. And music and wine, the end result is always going to be very much an extension of the person who created it.
Composer Brooke Monroe says that he is in the early stages of creating another album, all while making wine full time. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.